This episode of the podcast is sponsored by Issue.com and Calm.com, and I'll tell you more about both of them very soon. Gabby Roslin Podcast. Hello and welcome to that Gabby Roslin Podcast. My lovely guest this week is another person with funny bones. It's the brilliantly talented actor, comedian and author Ben Miller. He shares with me some amazing stories. We chat about experiencing weightlessness and wanting to go to the moon and writing his excellent children's books. This supremely intelligent man has both a science degree and a PhD in physics from Cambridge, and he tells the wonderful story of how he got into the famous footlights. Plus, his brilliant working relationship with Alexander Armstrong and how he regularly gets mistaken for Rob Brydon. Enjoy. Please, can I ask you a favour? Would you mind, please, following and subscribing, please, by pressing the follow or subscribe buttons, please. This is completely and utterly free, by the way. And then you can also rate and review on Apple Podcasts, which is the purple app on your iPhone or iPad. Simply scroll down to the bottom of all of the episodes and you'll see the stars where you can tap and rate. And also, please write a review. Thank you so much. How many places was that? Probably too many, but please, thank you. I have to let you into a rather embarrassing secret. Okay. So here we go. I dreamt about you last night. Would you like to know my dream?
Yes, I would. I would like to know, first of all, where the dream was set.
In Morocco.
Ah, well, that's interesting.
Yes, because that's where you've just come back from.
Yes, I've just come back from there. Yeah.
Yeah, well, because I was doing all of my reading and my researching before I went to sleep last night, I dreamt that I came to see you in Morocco and you taught me how to fill up a helium balloon with a tagine.
Yeah, that makes complete sense. That makes complete sense. I think, what did we use the helium balloon to, what did we do then? Was it like, as a helium balloon as in... you know, just the sort of thing you get at a party, that kind of thing.
Well, it was huge.
It was massive.
It was huge, but it was inflated, but it had this massive big hole at the end and the air wasn't coming out of it. And you said, this is how to cook a tagine. You put it in there and then Abraham Lincoln came to eat it.
Now that is a brilliant mishmash of... What your subconscious has done there is basically taken three facts you've learned about me and juggled them in the air all night.
Yes.
That's fascinating. Because, yes, I have a big connection with Morocco and, in fact, therefore with tagines. Helium, that would be the science, because I used to do experiments with helium when I did my PhD. Helium is the... when you liquefy helium, it's the best way to get things to the lowest temperatures known on Earth, basically, is to... Well, I won't go into too much detail, but basically...
No, please do.
Well, basically, you use liquid helium. You use a mixture of helium-3 and helium-4, and you pump off the vapour, and the liquid helium-3, helium-4, goes to some of the lowest temperatures on the planet, so you can get to tens of thousands of a degree above absolute zero. Absolute zero being the lowest temperature anything can possibly have, where it's essentially got no free energy. So, yeah. That's good. So you've taken the helium bit of that. Not entirely sure where the balloon comes from.
No, because I think I read something about when you did a kids show, you did an experiment with balloons.
They did. Oh, yes. Yeah. So because I love science, I went on The Sky at Night with my friend Brian Cox. And he decided that I was going to experience what it would be like to be weightless on the moon. So I think, off the top of my head, I think it's something like an eighth or a tenth of the gravity it is on Earth. So the way they did that was they tied lots of helium balloons to me. And I was literally floating. You know, when you see those pictures of the astronauts bouncing, like taking those long, loping steps.
Was it like that?
Oh, it was amazing. It's the most incredible feeling. To experience low gravity, which I basically did. I just had lots of helium balloons tied to me until let's say for argument's sake, an eighth of my weight, if that is what the if that is what
well,
it is.
So how did how many balloons were there? I mean, not terribly heavy, but
a lot of balloons, Gabby. A lot of
balloons.
A lot of balloons. I would say 50 balloons. There's a lot of balloons. There's a lot of balloons. But the best bits of that show weren't filmed, which was them trying to get me. Because, of course, to begin with, they put on too many balloons. You start floating off, and then there's, yeah, I mean, it's just it's absolutely brilliant.
Yes!
And also, when they got the right number of balloons, you know, and I was about an eighth of my weight, I got quite giddy. You know, like you see the astronauts go giddy. That is not just them. What I realised, that is not just them experiencing weightlessness. You experience a very strange kind of joy when you're suddenly relieved of all your weight. You know, we struggle under this enormous gravitational pressure. You know, we're stuck basically to the surface of the earth, aren't we? We don't really think about it, but we can't leave. We're just rammed down to the surface of the earth by gravity. And suddenly, when you don't have that holding you down, and you can just jump as high as you like, and you can go straight. Anyway, I just went bouncing off across, it was at Jodrell Bank, and I just went bouncing off across the field, just absolutely cock-a-hoo.
Oh, wow.
I mean, and I was having the, of course, you know, then you have the producer sort of screaming in your ear that you're going to, you know, health and safety, get back here, you're not allowed to do that, you're not allowed, you know. So unfortunately that bit wasn't on camera, but that was the most fun. I mean, can you imagine? Not to be weightless.
No, I can't.
Neither can I. I'm supposed to.
What does it feel like?
It feels like you know that is emotion. It's emotional, I suppose. It's that thing where you suddenly you've been worrying about something and you realise you don't have to worry about it anymore, and you get that sort of emotion. You feel like a weight has been lifted from your shoulders. We say that, don't we? Well, it is like it's very emotional. You suddenly feel very joyful and free and released. For just a moment from gravity, released from your gravitational obligations. And off you go, bouncing across whatever field happens to be in front of you or jumping over people, as I did. I decided to try and jump over one of the assistant producers. I think that's what really got them cross.
But, you know, isn't it funny, though, when you ask any child, actually, usually a child, but if you ask an adult as well, if you could have a superhuman power... Most people say, I want to be able to fly.
I want to fly. Yeah, it was me too. I mean, I believed when I was a child, I sort of believed I could fly. I just believed I didn't really ever want to do it when there were other people around. You know, so when I was on
really?
My own, I would sort of go and fly. Yeah, and I used to have lots of dreams about flying. It is that feeling. It is that feeling. It's a suddenly, yeah, I mean, it's emotional. It's totes emosh. You just want to run off. You feel like you've suddenly been released from gravitational prison, and you're just going to make a break for it before anybody can.
Would you go into space now? I mean, that sounds. I know it's a big leap, ha ha. But that wasn't meant as a pun. But it's a huge leap from being tied to 80 balloons to 50 balloons, whatever it was.
I would love to
going into space.
Of course, I would love to. I mean, I'd love to experience. I mean, it's weightlessness they actually experience, isn't it? On those, some of those, they call it the vomit comet, I think, don't they? Which is the aeroplane which goes up into the upper atmosphere and then just basically free falls, so that you experience for a few, I think it's maybe just a few minutes, you experience what it's like to be weightless. That's how they sort of do all that film, you know, stuff like Apollo 13, they film in those, you know, they filmed in those, as I say, sort of vomit comet planes. I'd love to do that. But then, of course, soon we might all be able to go, you know, on Virgin Galactic, won't we? And sort of,
well,
and Elon Musk
is not
far behind, is he? With his sort of, we'll be shuttling to the moon soon, won't we?
I sort of don't want us to, though. I just think, haven't we done enough damage to this planet? That's getting a bit deep, but I do wonder, you know, why should we go and ruin somewhere else?
I know, we're going to mess up the moon, aren't we? There's just going to be rubbish then, sort of lying on the moon, sort of empty crisp packets and, yeah. No, it's a depressing thought.
When you were a child, though, and thinking that you could fly, what you do now, I know it's, but you, all the magical books that you write, so I will talk about all the acting and the comedy and all of that as well, but the writing that you do and the retelling of the fairy tales and everything, that's done through, it's done through a child's eyes. And I know you were writing them for your kids, if I'm right in thinking that you were writing them for your kids, but I love that you have this incredibly childlike view of life. And I hope you, I hope all of us have that actually still in us.
That's one of the greatest things. That's one of the things I love most about writing for children. So yes, you're right. I mean, I started writing these books for my children. I've been writing a book for each of them. So the first book, The Night I Met Father Christmas, was for my oldest son, Jackson. And then The Boy Who Made the World Disappear was for Harrison. This one now, The Day I Fell Into a Fairy Tale, is for my daughter, Lana. And you're absolutely right. I mean, it is them in the stories. I mean, they are the main characters in the stories, but it's also me. And I think one of the joys about sort of doing acting for a living is you never really grow up. I mean, we are treated like children, actors. You know, I'm doing sort of a filming job at the moment, and you are. I mean, people walk you to the toilet. I mean, it's. I'm not joking. You say, please, can I go to the toilet? And they decide whether you can go to the toilet. And if you can go to the toilet, they walk you to the toilet and they wait outside until you're finished. And then they
what
walk you
back. What do
they think
you're going to do?
I have no idea. But I can only think that throughout history, actors have sort of gone to the toilet, forgotten they were acting, just sort of wandered off and done other things. Or, you know, I can only imagine it's there for good reason, because they have to pay these people. You are told when you can have your food, you know, you're told what you can eat, you're told when you can, you know, you are literally treated very much like a child. And it's a very childlike existence. You're basically paying let's pretend, don't you? I mean, you dress it up as, you know, dress it up with as much research as you like. But really, at the end of the day, you're sort of pretending to be somebody, aren't you? So it's a very childlike existence. And I think the challenge of acting, and I think probably writing too, certainly the writing I do, is just not to grow up. It's not really to ever get really, it's not to ever really forget, to forget the joy of really, of just playing around. So it's a great, writing the books is just a great opportunity really for me to reimagine, not even reimagine, just really remember and put myself back into the age that I'm writing for. So at the moment, you know, it was 9 for Lana's book. I really remember that so well. I remember being a child.
You remember being 9?
I remember being 9, yeah. I mean, I remember, I really specifically, like a lot of kids, I don't remember much before 7. But from 7 onwards, you can remember quite a lot. I really remember my year of 9 turning to 10 very well. And I remember in incredible clarity everything from sort of 13 onwards. It's very interesting. You know, we sort of jettison a lot of ourselves at 7, and then we jettison a lot again when we sort of turn 15, 16. But you know, we hang on to some of it, don't we? We remember. You know,
what do you remember? You said you remember about 9 to 10. Is there a specific thing that you remember?
Oh, yeah, no,
what
I remember
do you mean?
The dens that I used to play. I was really, really lucky in that we lived in a market town, but we lived at the very edge of the market town, and it was just fields out to the back. It was in Cheshire, growing up in sort of rural Cheshire, and just fields out the back of our house. I remember every inch of those fields and the dens that we used to build and the stream, and that was my kind of little Wind of the Willows sort of territory out of the back. And I think I owe it a lot to the fact that I'm not sure it would be the same if I'd grown up in a city. You know, I don't know if you'd have the same, because so little happened. It was quite easy to remember the few things that happened.
But that's lovely, actually, for now, I suppose, as well, when we have to. I know you say you're filming, but in the first lockdown, there you were in Morocco. And that's why I dreamt of being in Morocco with you. I mean, I wasn't there. You were there with your family. Bit weird if I was suddenly there. But that would be very strange. But you probably, that's what helped you appreciate that. I don't know. Maybe that I'm being too sort of deep about it.
It is. I think... Well, it's really interesting when you get to some sort of. I lived in London. I love cities, and I love central London. And I think having, as I say, sort of grown up in the countryside, just then going to really wanting to be go to the city. And you know, about 5 years ago, I moved out here, sort of rural Gloucestershire. So sort of done the, yeah. So that's really interesting. It was once I moved here that I started writing the children's stories. That's another thing.
Oh, right.
Once I moved back into the countryside, I think that's when I started remembering my own childhood and becoming more connected with that. But where we were in Morocco, quite an amazing story. So, sort of rewinding, just sort of rewinding the videotape slightly from where we are now back to last March. It's about the middle of March, I think. It's about the sort of, 11th or 12th, something like that. We were thinking, oh, this doesn't look good. It looks like if we want to get a holiday in, we better go now. So we decided to go with these friends of ours, we decided, look, let's just go for a 10-day, 10-day holiday now and, get some sort of satchels. We booked this holiday and headed over to Morocco. And literally the day we arrived, Morocco locked down because they were way ahead of the UK in terms of lockdowns. And Morocco is just sort of close to all its borders and close to the thing. And we were there for 4 months from when we arrived. So I had sort of 10-day holiday with this family that we were going to share this house with, this other family, and they had got 3 kids. And we had our 2 youngest kids with us. So it was, 5 kids, 4 adults, 5 kids. We were outnumbered. And we had this most amazing experience because...
You were all together?
We were all together in this house, yeah.
Oh, my word.
We were all together in this house for 4 months, yeah. I mean, it was quite strange. It was like living in a sort of, a bit like a commune, I suppose. It sort of made me think, actually, I understand communal living a lot more than I did. There's a lot, it's a funny thing. Parenting is quite, parenting's full on at the best of times, but it's sort of, when there are lots of children and lots of parents together, it somehow gets easier and you sort of realise, this must be how people used to live in sort of communities with kids running around and then you'd all be sort of vaguely responsible for whatever children there were. And I suddenly thought, have a new perspective on the whole thing.
It's quite an extraordinary thing though, for 4 months to be living in a different country with, I didn't realise it was with another family and escaping from here.
Yeah,
from
so we escaped, but it was odd really because of course Morocco's policy really was just to sort of lock everything down and nobody could leave the house, and that didn't really change much over the 4 months, whereas back home things were sort of opening up in May, sort of things started to relax a bit, didn't they, so that was an odd stretch really. There was a point where it didn't really matter much where you were. You were all going to be doing the same thing, just staying indoors. And then, and then there was that sort of odd period where, things were sort of opening up in the UK, but they weren't really opening up in Morocco. I mean, I think probably, nobody's really known, have they, what the right, nobody's, I don't think anybody's got much idea what the right thing to do is. But it's interesting, it was very interesting to be in a country like Morocco where they decided to lock down very, very early and there were therefore very, very few cases. That's what was interesting.
So when did you get back to the UK?
Middle of July.
Wow.
Yeah, on a repatriation.
I mean, it sounds rather lovely if I'm honest. It does sound, quite magical that you were there in Morocco in the heat. And...
It was magical. It was wonderful. There was a couple of funny things about it. One was we had the most incredible weather in the UK, and it was terrible in Morocco. Almost one leads to the other. You see, I think that's something to do with I don't know what it is, the polar jet or whatever. But they say in Morocco, if it's good in Morocco, it's bad in Europe, and vice versa. So you guys had all the good weather, which was it actually snowed in Morocco in April or something, which was sort of unheard of.
Snow?
Yeah. I mean, we actually had hailstones and snow. Yeah, and we were just outside Marrakesh. It was very unusual.
You see what we're doing to our planet? I said it at the beginning.
I told you. But it was an amazing experience culturally, as you can imagine. It's very... Because you suddenly sort of... You stop being a tourist and now you're a sort of local after some point. And that was really... Moroccans are amazing. Moroccans are so friendly and funny, and we've got a lot in common, actually. That British sense of humour, the Moroccans have a very, very strong sense of humour as well. Always, always joking and very present, I suppose. Very kind of, you know, very in the moment and very stoic. So it was quite, you know, it was quite a good British place to be culturally, you know.
Now I'd like to tell you all about the first sponsor of this episode. It's Issue. Now, first impressions are everything. So if you're looking to make an impact with your online content, you need Issue. It's the easiest way to make your creative ideas come to life and share everywhere you want to be seen. Lots of people find posting creative content in all the right places online quite daunting, like me, I really do, because of the reformatting, resizing, re-downloading and re-uploading involved. If that's you, like me, you need Issue. Trust me, it is so easy to use. If I can do it, anyone can do it. Issue is the all-in-one platform to create and distribute beautiful digital content, from marketing materials to magazines to flipbooks, brochures and more. Make it once and distribute it everywhere without reformatting. Your content is already optimized for engagement and ready to share. It also works seamlessly with tools that you already use, like Canva, Dropbox and InDesign. And you can start using Issue for free. They also offer premium features that give a more customized experience. Get started with Issue today for free. Or if you sign up for a premium account, you'll get 50% off when you go to issue.com/podcast and use the promo code Gabby. So let me spell it for you. That's issue.com/podcast. Then use the promo code GABY at checkout for your free account or 50% off your premium account.
I could talk to you about science all day because I don't understand it. So you could tell me anything and I just say yes. I really have never got science, so I apologise. But the funny side I do get, and I love all of that. But how did that switch happen when you were at university? Because there you were going off to do science and then suddenly you were, was it through Footlights? Were you in Footlights?
It was, yes, I was in Footlights. So I was studying natural sciences, which is a sort of so I went to Cambridge, and you don't really study individual sciences at Cambridge until your sort of final year. So everybody studies natural sciences, which is basically you pick three sciences and then sort of each year you drop one science and then you specialise in your final year. So I sort of specialised in physics and then stayed on and did a PhD in physics at the Cavendish Laboratory, which is a fantastic experimental laboratory, which has the most extraordinary history. It's where, J.J. Thompson discovered the electron. All kinds of amazing scientists have been based there, and it's got this sort of incredible history and it does incredible research. So I kind of joined a research group that were studying what's called mesoscopic physics. So when you have really, really small things that are about the size of atoms, that's physicists call that microscopic. And then everyday objects like my teacup here, we call macroscopic. But you can imagine as you get small, as you start with a teacup and you get smaller and smaller and smaller and smaller, so you've got a few hundred atoms, that's what we call mesoscopic. So it's sort of there's a weird, sort of uncanny valley between macroscopic everyday things and very strange microscopic atom-sized things. And that's called mesoscopic physics. And I joined a group in the semiconductor physics. I joined the semiconductor physics group where we were studying mesoscopic electron systems. So it's basically electrons confined to small spaces, not as small as an atom and not as big as an everyday object, if you see what I mean. And it turns out you can see some amazing, what we call quantum mechanical effects, which is as most people know now, the atomic world is very, very different to the everyday world. Objects don't behave. You can't even really use our language to talk about how objects the size of atoms behave. Our language is so designed to talk about the size of everyday objects that it doesn't really work. But we have got mathematics to describe it. And you can see some of that really extraordinary quantum mechanical behavior in semiconductors, basically. So I was doing a PhD in that, and it was, I mean, really, really fascinating, really, really interesting, doing these amazing experiments, which more or less involved, as I was saying, they build these, I mean, there's about three floors in the Cavendish Laboratory, and they would build these enormous thermos flasks that would, they'd be like, the height of the thermos flask would be about two stories within the building. And then you'd,
oh my goodness.
Yeah, and then you'd have a rod, which would be another two stories worth of rod so you would go up into the eaves of the Cavendish. You'd pull out this huge rod from the middle of this enormous thermos flask, and you'd put your tiny little semiconductor device on the end of it. And then you'd spend all night lowering it sort of centimetre by centimetre into the thermos flask, because the liquid at the bottom of the flask was at such a low temperature that if you put the... imagine if you lowered the rod too quickly, the difference in temperature would just cause an explosion. So you would just sort of lower this thing overnight until you...
Not with your hands. Not with your hands.
Yeah, well, you know, you'd be... Yeah, I mean, you'd just... Yeah, I mean, you'd be pushing the rod down in sort of by hand, yeah, measuring a centimetre and then lowering it a centimetre. And then you'd... So it would take hours and hours and hours to get your sample into the bottom of this giant... thermos flask where the really, really cold helium-3, helium-4 was. And then you would pump it all off. You'd pump off the helium-3 and helium-4 to get the temperature. You'd have a little thermometer in there. So once you could see that the temperature was a few tens of thousands above absolute zero, you'd then start making measurements. You could then, you know, do all sorts of things, start making measurements, see what was going on in your little sample. Oh, my word. It'd been so exciting. And you'd suddenly see, you'd have this graph paper and this, you know, sort of, you know, electric graph, sort of drawing out what you were discovering in that sample. I mean, really, really. And you'd know you were the only person in the entire world that could see that at that moment. And that was something new that no one had ever seen before. It's very sort of very, very exciting thing to do. Anyway, while I was doing that PhD, I got really interested in comedy. I thought, I'll audition for a play. And I auditioned for, there was a production of Julius Caesar. I mean, amazingly, in the cast of Julius Caesar was David Farr, who sort of then went on to write The Night Manager. It was directed by Gareth Edwards, who now produces Mitchell and Webb and Upstart Crow in the moment with Ben Elton. So I auditioned for this play and I got the part of Cassius, and Cassius in Othello. So Cassius is the one whose handkerchief gets stolen by Iago and then planted so that Othello thinks Desdemona's having an affair. And, or maybe it's the other way around. Maybe Iago steals Desdemona's handkerchief and gives it to Cassius. That would make more sense, wouldn't it? But anyway, however it works, I would come on stage as Cassius, trying to impose my authority on the scene. And people would just start laughing. And I would go on night after night. I'd learn my lines so carefully. I'd take it all so seriously. Night after night, people would just start involuntarily laughing. And there'd be gales of laughter as I was saying my lines. And I remember thinking, I don't really know what's going on here. But I wonder if I could turn this... I'm obviously... a disaster as a classical actor. But I wonder if I could turn this. I wonder if I try. I'm trying to act serious and people are laughing at me. I wonder if I did that in comedy, whether people would still laugh. So then I joined the Footlights, you know, the comedy society. And sure enough, I found that the more serious I took something in a sketch, the more people laughed. And that was the beginning of it, really. That was like the germ of the whole thing. I thought, wow, I could...
It was just as simple as that.
Isn't that ridiculous?
But it is. But what an incredible thing to do, because a lot of actors who would be laughed at would then feel I mean, brokenhearted and feel that they'd done something so wrong and would go away.
I loved
and do
it.
The full...
That was the other thing. I loved being laughed at. That was the other thing. I really loved that feeling of people laughing. But to begin with, of course, I had no control of it. I didn't know why it was happening. I don't know what was going on. But now I thought, well, if I can, there must be something in this. There must be something in acting things as well as I can. But you're letting the situation be funny. And then hopefully, by extension, I'll be funny. And it's basically, I've been just trying to do some version of that ever since.
But the stuff that you've done with Alexander, you don't do ya-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta comedy. It's straight, but it's very, very, very funny.
Well, I mean, Paul Merton said something once, which he said that we were the only double act with two straight men. I think he's right, actually. I thought at the time, that's a bit cutting. But then I thought, actually, he's actually put his finger.
It's a compliment. It's a huge compliment.
It's actually what it is. It actually exactly what it is. Is we both play straight. Usually there's a funny man and a straight man, isn't there? But we both play straight. We both play it completely straight. And the situation is, or the character is the funny thing, or the situation is the funny thing. But all we do is we just act it as well as we can. And that's funny. The fact that we're trying to, the fact that we're in this.
That's what we love.
Yeah.
That's what we love as viewers. And also there's that thing, because obviously I know you in real life as well, face to face in real life. And you have, you and Alexander both, I remember meeting him so many years ago through a mutual friend. And I just remember laughing. And it's the same thing. You have that thing, you have that sort of, that little naughty grin. I'm going to go back to you being quite childlike.
Yeah.
That naughty grin that you're going to put a whoopee cushion under somebody's seat. Both of you seem to have that. So even when he's singing his very serious songs or
there's a twinkle,
you know, he, whatever, yeah. There's that twinkle. And I do talk about that twinkle with people. And I think that some people just have it and it's naughty. And I think, and also, so I love naughty humour, but I mean, you know, I love postcards from the seaside sort of humour, carry on humour. But I love,
yes.
I love the sort of the twinkle and the little grin and all of that. But you're also incredibly polite. Yeah. And I like that in humour. It's not about irony. It's not about being cruel. It's not about being rude. It's just funny. It's proper laughing in your tummy funny.
Yes, yeah, yeah. Xander makes me laugh like nobody. There's something, that was a very, very joyous moment. Do you know, I sort of stole him from another comedy partner. This is an awful, awful, awful thing. But I was sharing a flat with Jez Butterworth, who is very well known now as a playwright, who wrote play Jerusalem.
Brilliant,
amazing
playwright. Wow.
And Jez was in a play with Xander. And then Jez said to me one night, Xander's doing, you know, Xander's this very funny guy who's in this play that I'm in. He's going to do a show at the, I think it was the Etc. Theatre in Camden. I mean, to call it a theatre is quite a, you know, it's quite a leap of imagination. It was a sort of just a sweaty black box in a basement in Camden. It was one of the fringe theatres have, there's a particular smell that you get when you go into a pub. It was one of those fringes, that particular smell where you think, there's been no window open in here for about 15 years and people have been performing very sweaty fringe plays in here. It was that kind of, you know, it was absorbed by all the sort of black curtains and everything.
Yeah.
We sat in this tiny theatre and Xander and his double act partner, who was David Wollstonecraft. Now, do you know who David Wollstonecraft is?
I don't know.
He is the man who wrote Spooks.
Oh, my word.
Yeah, so, but at this time was doing sketch comedy with Xander. He was he's a very gifted impressionist, David Wollstonecraft, funnily enough, the man who wrote Spooks. Anyway, so we are watching David and Xander on stage, and they are brilliant. But I sort of fall in comedy love with Xander, and I start sending him. This is awful, 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 awful. I start I started doing little sketches, like love letters, but just sort of writing a little sketch.
Oh, I thought you were going to send you scented flowers and bottles of beer.
Well, I was just, I'd send perfume. little notes with like a sketch, here's a little sketch we might perform, that sort of thing. And anyway, he succumbed eventually. I said, look, why don't we do a show at Edinburgh, at the Fringe Festival? He said, okay. And then we started rehearsing. We were rehearsing on the King's Road and we decided to go out at lunchtime and buy some comedy props. And I really remember very, very clearly that we bought a rubber chicken. I don't remember what we thought we would do with this rubber chicken. We had our arms...
Always funny.
So we had our arms full of comedy props. And I do remember Zander was carrying this rubber chicken. And we were walking down the King's Road and David Wollstonecraft came towards us. And I said to Zander, you have told him, haven't you? He said, no, I haven't told him. And David came up and said, hi, guys. What are you up to? And we said,
oh,
nothing. We're just sort of doing a bit of shopping, just sort of wandering around. And he looked, I remember him looking at the rubber comedy chicken. Zander goes, yeah. He said, yeah, good. Zander, do you think we might do any, you think we might do any more shows? And Zander's going, yes, I'm sure we might, might do something. Anyway, we're just off. We're just going to go for a little while. It's the most awkward. Can you imagine?
Awkward
situation.
Stealing somebody else's partner, caught
in flagrante. I mean, the only thing that would have been worse if he'd walked in and we were actually doing a sketch with the rubber chicken. That's the only thing that could have been worse. But we didn't even tell him then. That's what made me laugh. Zander didn't even say then, are we doing a show?
Does he know now?
I think he may still be waiting at the Etc. Theatre counter, drumming his fingers. Writing the odd script for Spooks while he does it, of course. But yes, drumming his sort of fingers on the tabletop, thinking, wondering when Zander's going to turn up. Oh, Gabby, isn't that awful?
Yeah, it is. It's a cruel.
All is fair in love and war. All is fair.
No, but I was saying all these lovely things about how polite you two are and
clearly
what gentlemen
not.
You are. Forget it.
No, forget
obviously
it.
Not.
Forget
especially
it.
Not that Alexander. Goodness me.
I'd now like to tell you all about the second sponsor of this episode. Calm.com. Are you a little bit worried about going back to the office? If working from home is coming to an end, a change in your environment can make it hard to focus on everyday tasks. We've all had that fear. We've all had that worry. Well, Calm can help reduce stress so that you can increase your concentration. Now, Calm works. I've been using this app for a very, very long time and I love it. Now, we're partnering with Calm, the number one mental wellness app, to give you the tools that improve the way you feel. Clear your head with guided daily meditations, improve your focus with Calm's curated music tracks, and drift off to dreamland with Calm's imaginative sleep stories, which I love listening to. And if you go to calm.com/Gabby, you'll get a limited time offer of 40% off a Calm premium subscription, which includes hundreds of hours of programming, and new content is added every week. Over 100 million people around the world use Calm to take care of their minds. I love it. Sleep more, stress less, live better with Calm. For listeners to the show, Calm is offering a special limited time promotion of 40% off a Calm premium subscription at calm.com/Gabby. Go to calm.com/GABY for 40% off unlimited access to Calm's entire library.
I always ask in this podcast, what makes you properly belly laugh? And I think you sort of answered it already, that it's Alexander.
And when we get together, it's a very, very lucky thing that when we're together, we're such different people, but share a lot of the same values and have very, very have the same sense of humour, basically. And Zander I've always found it so hard to keep a straight face when he does anything. It's just extraordinary. I'm doing this podcast with him at the moment, and he sort of puts on this voice like this, he talks like this.
I've listened, it's very funny.
It's really, I mean, but some of the And I'm the one who's laughing all the time. It really annoys him. I'm always the one who's laughing because he does sort of ridiculous sound like this when he's sort of talking. And I'm trying to do a character. You know, I'm trying to do a character with a limited degree of success. I sort of, my problem is I keep sort of just forgetting that I'm a character and just talking as myself. And his problem is he goes more and more into this sort of very bizarre sort of adenoidal pronunciation. And he, this is one of the things I really, really admire about Alexander as a performer, is he can, it's very hard to go big as a performer. I'm quite good at going small, and I know my limits, but going big I find very difficult. One of the things I've always loved about Alexander as a performer is he goes, when he goes bigger, he gets funnier. As most people, when you go bigger, it's not as funny. And the bigger he goes, the funnier it is. And he will go to, he literally knows no limits. He literally knows no limits to how big
I love that.
I love that. It's very
makes me, but you two make me thing. properly laugh. I just your old sketches and stuff that you do, and then I was listening to your podcast yesterday because I was going to be chatting to you today, and I was doing the same thing that. And it's slightly embarrassing that when I see you, I just giggle. You used to live around the corner from me, and if I drove past you, I'd giggle like a stupid child. And then you very kindly came on another show recently, and you walked in, and I giggled. And if I ever see Alexander sing, which it's so cruel because he can really sing, I laugh because he makes me. And it's a horrible thing to admit. And we were somewhere together, and it was a charity event, and he was singing, and I started laughing, and I felt so guilty. No, and he just wonderful. Said, I don't mind. Oh no, but it's him. Wonderful. He's a proper it's singer.
There's nothing better. I can only speak for myself, but I love that. You do see that when some people, it's a funny thing, you know, because you might be in a situation where you're not really going to particularly say anything funny, but you literally say something like, oh, I'm so sorry, I couldn't find a parking space. And people start laughing because I think they are conditioned to think, you know, that, you know, and that I've always found that a wonderful, you know, a wonderful thing. I love that. I love that when people are sort of already giggling because, you know, they've seen you be silly for so many years. I mean, why wouldn't you? You know, you've seen somebody be so sort of silly for years, year upon year.
But you can do all your straight acting. So you do the, you fly out to the Caribbean, you live there for 6 months, you do the number one drama on television that nobody, you know, when you left, everyone was devastated. Oh. But and it was charming. It was absolutely, it still is very charming.
Well, thank you. But drama. It is funny. But I'm also being, you know, that's the thing. You know, I sort of, it's you also funny. Funny. It's also, it's also, there's something funny that I can't do anything about that.
No, but laughter is. I always say that laughter is the best medicine. I really, really believe it, and I think in the world as it is and everything, we all need to laugh. But I get the thing. I when you said that you went out on stage in Shakespeare and people just laughed, and I was saying to you, or most actors would be upset. But actually, I'm so pleased that you've given me the opportunity to tell you that you don't. I just have to see your face, and I laugh,
yeah.
And I mean that. With deep love, I really, really do, because you're one of those people that makes me laugh. You and Alexander and Rob Brydon, as I said, who I'm speaking to this week. And I still can't believe that people think you're the same person. That's weird. You're very different.
We are different. I've been mistaken for Rob Brydon for so long. I have to think that we do look, that there has to be some sort of similarity, but I'm delighted. I'm always delighted. And I used to, Rob and I, we don't do it so much anymore, but we used to always pass on the compliments. So if somebody came and gave me a compliment about him, I would text him and I'd give him a brief description, aww, you know, sort of woman, you know, mid 30s, looked slightly harried, possibly, you know, family shopping, really enjoyed Marion and Jeff. Do you know what I mean?
So lovely.
And he would do the same for me. It sort of became after a while. And then there became an appointment, I think, for both of us. You can check this with him when you speak to him. But for both of us, I now just pretend I am him. I think it's just sort of easier. and I will happily sign things with Rob's name and sort of take any kind of compliment going, you know, you enjoyed the trip, really. Oh, that's excellent. Even do a slight sort of, oh, that's wonderful. There we go. Sign that for you then. Lovely chatting to you.
Oh, my God, you sound like him. Yeah. That's really freaky.
And,
does he do you as well as you can do him?
I imagine better. I mean, Rob is a proper, you know.
He's a brilliant. Oh, yes, he is very good.
Don't you love the chat? I think that's one of
it's
my
fantastic.
Absolute treasured possessions, my little, you know, digital versions of the trip. I find him and Steve together, yeah.
With you, with all of you guys, that you all know each other, and that you've all been in this extraordinary business for the same length of time, and you all have that same gift, that laughter gift, which is a gift. It seems to be that there's maybe back in the 80s that people were very, no, we want this and we want this and we're going to fight because we want this and we want this. It seems much more now that you're very supportive of one another.
I loved it when I started doing comedy, I have to say, because I did do a little bit of sort of straight acting at college and I loved it. As soon as you went to the Gilded Balloon and you met the other comedians, you sort of felt like you'd found your people because it was so supportive.
Oh, wow.
Everybody, comedians are very, very supportive of one another. It's a remarkable thing.
Didn't used to be like that years ago. There was a cynicism about it.
There was in the 80s, I think, but in the 90s when we all sort of started. So, you know, I was, you know, the same time as the sort of the League of Gentlemen and, you know, Matt and Dave and Steve Coogan, you know, we were all around sort of at the same time and we were all trying to do a similar thing, which was really, we were trying to break through with character comedy, which wasn't really popular at the time. It was stand-up comedy that was the thing, and we were all part of a sort of, you know, a group of people trying to get our sort of toe in the door, really. So there was a lot of, I suppose it's partly that. I suppose it's always been quite fraternal, the sort of comedy community. But also I think as you get older, I'm probably going to speak for myself, but as you get older, you get more appreciative as well of the opportunities that you've had. You get more appreciative of other people's talents. You get just generally, you just get an idea of how lucky you are, don't you? As it goes on, you sort of think, oh, wow, when I was younger,
oh,
I sort of maybe took
yes.
this for granted slightly, but now I realise what an extraordinarily fortunate position I've been in. And you develop a real fondness for your cohort, I think, for people who've been through the same, you know, been through the same experiences you have and sort of come through the same, you know, come through the same school of comedy, you know.
Can I make a suggestion that all of you, what we really, really need is all of you coming together to do something together.
That'd be fun, wouldn't it? It would be lovely to do.
Yes.
It would be lovely to do. I mean, and to do something where we're all acting, I think would be great. Do you know what I mean? I mean, it'd be fun to do a sketch, you know, big sort of gang show type sketch show, wouldn't it? But it'd be also, I'd
yes,
also
but
love to do a drama, you know,
characters.
Like a kind of, yeah, character
yeah.
piece. I think that would be wonderful. There used to be things like that, didn't they? There was like things like Marple and stuff back in the day used to have a sort of extraordinary cast of characters, didn't they?
But you and Steve and Rob and Xander,
yeah.
And actually you've got to put David Tennant in there as well.
He's funnier than all of us put together, I think. When David decides
so
to be funny, he's unbelievably brilliant at it. Do you ever remember that People
podcast.
Like Us, well, his podcast is, he,
yeah,
podcast,
no, he did this,
podcast.
He was on this with Georgia and just, he's like you, he just, I can't help it. But I giggle and people think it's just, people think I'm really pathetic. I saw him in a lift. It was very embarrassing. We got into the lift and were chatting, saying hi. I started giggling. And he went, "You all right?" I went, "I'm really sorry. You make me laugh." And then I just thought, oh no, he's going to, and it's the same thing. Like I said, people with funny bones. And I do think there are people with properly funny bones.
And he's got them. I mean,
you have funny bones.
His,
you have them.
His People Like Us episode, I think, was just one of the, he plays a voice artist. Maybe it's available on YouTube, but if anybody gets a chance to sort of just Google it, he plays a voice artist and there's this absolutely brilliant, I mean, I can't really make it funny by describing it, but there's the producer sort of in the studio talking to the voice artist in the booth, and sometimes they can hear each other and sometimes they can't. And it goes on for about 10 minutes of each of them trying, not quite hearing what the other person said. And it's all down to David. So, so funny. I mean, brilliant, brilliant man.
Well, I feel like that about all of you guys. I really do. And I want you all to do something. And if there's a part for a stupid female to come in and just giggle at you all, I'd like to be, what I'd like to be is a multi-millionaire heiress, American, yeah. New York,
got it.
Jewish,
nice.
Heiress.
Got it.
I walk in and I just have to laugh and then you can kill me and that's fine and I would have been in it.
That's a plot. What you've described there is a plot. I think we've got the whole, okay. I think we've got the whole thing ready to go.
You all kill me. I don't mind. And I laugh while it's happening because yeah, I would just. You're a joy. You really are a joy. And still, the fact that you don't know how to tie a bow. Did nobody teach you, Julie, how to tie your laces?
Well, I was taught at school, obviously. People attempted to teach me when I was at school. I just couldn't ever get the hang of it. And then my father, my father was a polytechnic lecturer. You know, he was also. Anyway, it turned out he couldn't. This is the story. He couldn't tie his laces either, and he said, he took me to a side one day. He said, "Are you having trouble tying your laces?" And he said, "I can't do it either. This is how I do it." And he showed me this sort of bunny ears technique, which is what I've been doing ever since. It's cheating, but it's what I've been doing ever since. It works a treat for me. It works for my father, and I can only imagine that going back for generations and generations, ever since we've worn shoes with laces. That people in the Miller family have been quietly taking the younger generations to one side, saying, yeah, you want to try this bunny ears technique.
Cheat.
Cheat. This is how you do it. Cheat. Cheat.
Have you done that with your three?
I'm doing it with my son at the moment, who cannot tie his laces. I do think it's a genetic thing. I do think it's a genetic thing. Yeah, so I'm teaching him. Yeah, my oldest son, funny enough, managed it no problem. But my middle son has got exactly my problem of, whatever. I don't know what it is, but literally, it defeats me every time. I know what you're supposed to do. You're supposed to sort of, it seems insane to me. You're supposed to create a bow. You make one bow and then you're supposed to loop the other bit around somehow and pull it through some hole to make another bit. It doesn't make any sense. Just make two bows, tie them together. Easy.
You sound like my husband. We have this conversation because he does the bunny ears and I just think it's wrong, wrong, wrong. I wouldn't let him teach our girls that, so no. They have to do it the proper way. I will forgive you that because you just properly make me laugh. And for that, I thank you deeply. And you're just completely wonderful. So thank you very much for taking
lovely
part in this.
So to lovely you. To I chat. I do love your podcast. It's great. I mean, I think it's a podcast unlike any other. Your chats, I don't know how you do it, but you sort of, I think you start in the middle and then you work back to the edges. That's your technique, isn't it? But anyway, it's
I'm
been
very
lovely
nosy.
Chatting to you. Thank you so much.
Bless you. Have a lovely day.
You too. Bye for now.
Thank you so much for listening and thank you to our sponsors. Don't forget to go to issue.com, that's issuu.com/podcast, and use promo code GABY at checkout for your free account or 50% off your premium account. And Calm, go to calm.com, that's calm.com/Gabby for 40% off unlimited access to Calm's entire library. Coming up on the next episode is the very gorgeous Vicky Patterson. That Gabby Roslin podcast is proudly produced by Cameo Productions. Music by Beth Macari. Could you please tap the follow or subscribe button? And thanks so much for your amazing reviews. We honestly read every single one and they mean the world to us. Thank you so much.